Canada's immigration system is completely broken. It doesn't need tweaks or reforms. It needs a total overhaul. Today, we're going to have an in-depth conversation with an expert who really knows and has really thought about this issue. And we're going to talk about how to completely change and fix our broken immigration system. I'm Candace Malcolm, and this is The Candace Malcolm Show. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into the podcast today. So we have been talking about immigration recently on the show. We've been breaking down all of the numbers, which I find truly shocking how much our immigration system has grown, how many people we are admitting every year into this country, how many illegal immigrants enter the country every year and end up making asylum claims. The entire situation is completely out of control. There's no other way to put it. I am joined today by a friend of mine, Aaron Woodrick. He is the domestic policy director over at the McDonnell Laurier Institute. He was previously with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. That's how I know him. We worked together shortly over there. And Aaron has also practiced law in Kitchener. He's been a corporate lawyer in London, Hong Kong, and Dubai. And so basically the story is that Aaron and I were recently on a panel together and we were talking about immigration, that there's just so many issues when it comes to it. We had so many different kind of areas that we wanted to talk about. And then the panel that we did ended up being quite short. It was a great panel discussion hosted by Colin Craig over at Second Street. But we felt that there was so much more of a need to get into these issues more in depth, discuss them just at a deeper level. And so I invited Aaron to come on to the podcast and discuss them. So Aaron, welcome to the show and thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Candace. Great to have a chance to talk about these this important issue in a little more depth.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought the panel that we did was fun, but it was like, you know, 5 minutes to talk about like the biggest, most important issue and try to fix it. You know, it's like, okay, we need to spend a bit more time here. So you had a piece over in the on the McDonnell Laurier Institute website saying it's time for a grown-up conversation on immigration. That was back in January. And if I could just sort of give a little overview, you basically say that the challenges associated with immigration are incredibly different than they were 50 or 100 years ago, and that politicians, policymakers just haven't really been willing to update the conversation on immigration. You talk about the challenges broadly being in three categories: economic impact, infrastructure capacity, and cultural friction. So maybe we can just go through each of those right now. Or do you want to give a little overview of what your thoughts are and what you wrote, or do you want to get right into the economic impact?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I just wanted to say is part of the reason I wrote this is I think it's important to get ahead of this issue. I view this as actually a pro-immigration piece. I'm generally pro-immigration. I think immigration has been good for Canada historically. I make the piece, that argument in the piece. But the problem is things have changed. And then if we don't have this conversation, if we don't grapple with these realities and face the facts, we are going to lose support for immigration. I mean, we're already seeing that, and it makes perfect sense that we are. So I view this as trying to salvage what has been a helpful attitude towards immigration in this country. And if we don't deal with some of the harder truths, we're going to lose it, and we're going to see a very ugly reaction that I think is going to end up hurting Canada. So I wrote this not as an anti-immigrant diatribe or an anti-immigration diatribe, but as a way to try and salvage the best of what I think works for Canada while shaving off the things that are doing harm both to Canada and frankly also to immigrants themselves.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think that there is a sort of uniparty consensus when it comes to immigration that for a long time, you know, on the conservative side, people said, look, it's good for the economy. It's building the country. It's good for growth. Those are all things that we support. The liberal side, the very pro, like big M dogma of multiculturalism, Kumbaya, we can all live together, and also kind of an element of like erasing Canada's history and planting it with this new history, the kinds of elements that you and I would probably find pretty distasteful. But I agree that I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, that consensus is really wearing away, that I hear more and more from Canadians who just don't feel like immigration is working for them anymore. They don't feel that the leaders of this country are listening to their concerns. They don't feel that they're the ones who are at the center of the policy. And I think it's important to sort of start at the very first principle, like, why do we have immigration? Why is Canada a country that seems to prioritize immigration? Like, what is the purpose of our immigration system in your opinion?
Yeah, and if you can go back historically, right, we want, generally people want immigration because they want people to come to the country because they need someone to help. They need people to help build the country, especially a new country like Canada, a small, young country. We wanted to bring immigrants here to build up the country, to fill the space, right? There were concerns around time of Confederation. The West was this big open piece of land. So, you know, they were advertising in Europe, come to Canada and you get free land. And so there is a fundamental economic imperative for immigration. And maybe that's why, you know, in my piece, I started with the economic argument, because that really is the issue that cracked the door open on allowing us to debate this. If you go back, you know, maybe 10 years, anyone who expressed anything less than total enthusiasm for like immigration in any context anywhere was probably going to get called a racist, because there was an assumption that if you're against immigration, it must be because of, you know, people with different skin colors who eat different foods. The housing issue was the issue that really sort of affected so many people, and it was purely a numbers game. It's about demand, right? And adding immigrants, too many of them at one time, just spikes demand. And if not enough supply, that leads to high prices. This is Econ 101. That was the sort of thing that cracked the door open on the conversation and allowed us to at least start to begin debating this. I don't think we're quite yet there with the adult conversation, but we are starting to see more and more mainstream discussion about how do we have an immigration system that works well for Canada and for Canadians.
Well, it's interesting that you bring in housing, because we're often told by the political leaders in our country that the reason for like our vast open immigration system is because of labor market shortages. Like specifically, we're talking about there are jobs in Canada that we cannot fill, that companies are looking to hire people, but they can. I think construction is a pretty fair example of that. Like we clearly seem to have a housing shortage, and it seems that we don't have enough people to quickly build houses. Like whenever governments come up with proposals, it's like, okay, this is going to take like 8 years. It's like, why don't we just build them now? Well, maybe we don't have enough construction workers, but then the people that they're bringing into the country don't seem to be filling those. Like I'm not seeing huge influxes of like Polish construction workers coming in and building houses in Canada. What I see, and I think we have a clip of this, or we can play it, is that we have people coming into Canada without jobs, and then they end up coming in. Like there's a job fair at the Toronto airport or at Walmart or McDonald's, and you see dozens or hundreds of people lining up down the street to try to get minimum wage jobs. Well, minimum wage jobs historically have been for young Canadians, right? Like that's how you get your foot in the door. Like when I was 17 years old, I worked at a fish and chips shop, and that was my first job, and I learned how to have a job, right? And it's like when you have immigrants who are like in their 20s and they're coming and they're taking those minimum wage jobs, like what are young Canadians supposed to do? So what do you make of that sort of economic mismatch? Am I misreading it, or is that what you see happening?
You're right. Like in theory, the idea of, you know, if we've got a labor shortage, you bring in more labor, right? The problem is not all skills are fungible. So, you know, if you have people with particular skills, say construction skills, and you have a shortage of construction, then that's a good fit. But if you have people who come here that don't have construction skills, that's not really going to help you on the construction shortage issue. You reference things like service jobs, minimum wage jobs. I think you're right. I think a lot of the people who come here, and you can't really blame the immigrants, right? For them, that is a boon. They're coming from a country where they'd earn far less. So for them, it's a deal to come here and work for minimum wage at Tim Hortons. The question is, why can't we fill that labor with Canadians? You allude to younger Canadians that used to take these jobs. You know, part of the problem is a lot of those young Canadians they're not willing to take those jobs. And part of the reason they won't take them is because they look at those jobs and see, well, you know, if I earn $15 an hour, what can I even buy with $15 an hour? You get this, there is a malaise right now amongst our youth. And then even bigger than this, I would argue, in certain regions of the country, particularly in Atlantic Canada, you have a tradition of acceptance of seasonal work. And so you have, and this was the catalyst for a lot of bringing in temporary foreign workers, is you had employers in some parts of the country saying, we can't find anybody to work here. And that's probably true. But then the question shouldn't just be, oh, we're just going to import all these temporary workers to paper over it. It should be to re-examine the incentive structure and whether or not some of the entitlement programs are basically allowing Canadians to get away in some parts of the country with working only part of the year. I mean, they're papering over the symptoms, and they're not addressing the root problem here. And I think it just creates this toxic mix of consequences that has led in large part to the situation we're in today.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And look, if you're a young Canadian watching this, or if you have kids who are in that mold, you know, it's not about making money, right? It's about getting job experience and setting yourself up. Like, I might be dating myself by making this reference, but when I was in high school, I remember the minimum wage in British Columbia, I think it was $7 or $8 an hour. And then they brought in a new program, which if you were under a certain age and it was your first 500 hours working, the minimum wage dropped down to $5 an hour. So my first job, I was getting paid $5 an hour, whereas other people, their minimum wage, if they were older and had more experience, I think it was $8 or $10 an hour. And, you know, I worked, and sometimes I would go and have a shift at my fish and chip shop in West Vancouver, and I would have to pay for parking, and the parking would be like half of the money that I would make from the job. But it wasn't about that, right? It was just about learning how to get up, go to work, you know, the responsibilities. I was on the till. I had to learn a bit about money and cash register and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's not really about the money that you're making. Is it's about the skill, especially when you're a teenager and you're still living, you still have the benefit of living at home. I want to talk a little bit, Aaron, about the student visas and how that has come to play in all of this, because it seems like it's sort of a loophole that just allows another we had 900,000 students coming to Canada last year. And Aaron, I have to say, it's kind of sad. Like, these aren't 900,000 students that are going to like top ranked universities. Like, they're not going to UBC and McGill and the University of Alberta. A lot of them are kind of getting scammed. A lot of them are going to these weird schools that you and I have never heard of, that they exist in strip malls in suburban areas. And when you think about what these young people have done, you know, they've taken on huge risk. A lot of times they've taken out huge loans in their home countries. They've come across the world to Canada with the hopes of making a better world for them, but I don't know that that's going to happen. And, you know, you talk about how minimum wage in Canada might seem low for us. It might be a lot for someone who's from like rural India or something like that. But at the same time, they still have to afford to live in Canada. It's still incredibly expensive to rent an apartment or to find a house to live in. So they're still contributing to that cost of living crisis. What's your make of this whole student visa thing?
Well, I think you correctly identify part of the double tragedy here, right? Some people think that criticizing things like this student visa loophole is anti-immigrant. I don't see it that way at all. I see it as bad for Canadians and bad for these people who, as you say, in many cases have been misled. They've been promised this like amazing land of milk and honey, and they get here and they're trapped in an untenable situation. And in a lot of cases, you know, there is some evidence that they're essentially using the student visa approach because they can't get in through the PR stream. And so that there's sort of a perfect storm of incentives that's led to this, Candace, and it's this. It's that for a lot of these institutions, because politically it's very difficult for governments to allow tuition rates for Canadian students to rise. So they always capped or frozen those rates or kept them artificially low. That leaves a lot of universities and colleges looking around for other revenue streams. Well, guess what? They can charge international students way more because, and governments don't care about that because they obviously, these are students that obviously aren't either of age and don't live in Canada. So charging them a lot does not impact a government's political fortune. So that's exactly what a lot of these colleges and universities did. As soon as it became apparent that this was extremely lucrative, a lot of colleges and universities would double down on this stream. I mean, there's lots of evidence of some colleges, especially in Ontario and British Columbia, that like the number of international students over the last decade and a half has quintupled, or in some cases gone up 10 times. Because there's so much money to be made. So it's just a giant cash cow for them. And in fact, it's also spawned some of these for-profit institutes, which are essentially storefronts, that it's just a pure money-making model. And a lot of these students come here, they barely go to the to class at all. If they go, they simply find work. They don't pass the class, but the institution won't fail them because, of course, then they wouldn't be able to continue to charge them. So they graduate with their degree or their diploma. Now they can qualify through the PR stream, right? So this is basically just a penance that they've paid to qualify through the PR stream, and now they can bring their family over. And so you can see how it's basically trying to scam a system that was designed to weed these types of folks out because they did not meet the normal criteria through the PR stream. So I think it's a great tragedy. I think it does not serve either those folks coming or the people who are already here well. And, you know, the government has belatedly started to act on this, but it's going to take a while before they can right size, you know, what our carrying capacity is for a student stream.
I'm surprised to see a scam so out in the open. Like usually scams, you know, a journalist does some digging, they expose it, And then the scam ends because it's like, you can't do that. That's not right. That's not proper. Here we have, I mean, from 2013 to 2023, the number is 3X. We went from 300,000 international students a year to 900,000. I didn't realize that they could make that jump to permanent residency simply by graduating from a Canadian institution, and then they have the opportunity to get a permanent residency. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's a point system, right? And when you have that education, it increases your points. So it won't always be the case that you qualify through PR, but it increases your odds, right? And so a lot of people, if they know what the criteria are and getting that credential will get them over the hump, that then moves them into a different category. So you can see they're exploiting one loophole to then give them the points they need to access the other stream. And again, you know, we have that point system for a reason. It's designed to, coming back to the labor market issue, we want the people that match the skill set. And so, you know, if people can't get into that stream and they're trying to find a backdoor entrance, that is undermining the whole point of having a category that's set up with certain standards and with a certain cap on it.
It's really unbelievable. And also, I mean, I made this point on one of my shows the other day that you also have people who could potentially just claim asylum. Like if they know that they're not going to pass their classes and they're not going to qualify for PR, once you're physically in Canada, there's nothing stopping you from just saying, I'm a refugee. And then all of a sudden you get all these other kind of gold-plated privileges and entitlements for refugees. I want to just quickly talk about the refugee system. The landed asylum system. These aren't people who have gone through the United Nations and they're like determined to be refugees. These are people who come into Canada illegally and then make a claim for asylum, and some of them get accepted, some of them don't. We had 143,000 people come into Canada this way in 2023. 143,000. Aaron, I worked in the Harper government I worked in the immigration department. I was there in 2011, 2012. And back then we were talking about like 10 to 12,000 a year. And now we're talking about 140,000 people. What has happened, and what do you make of this? Is this also going to contribute to undermining public trust in immigration?
Yeah, I've got one point in defense of the migrants and two, I would say, against the status quo. The one in defense is I do think we need to keep perspective sometimes in terms of the amount of illegal and, you know, unlawful attempts to enter the country pale in comparison to Europe and America. I mean, 143,000 is a lot for a country like Canada, but we're simply blessed by geography to be harder to access. So, I mean, if we had a southern border like the United States does with Mexico, or borders like they do in Europe with neighboring countries, we would be experiencing, you know, millions of people trying to come here. So we should be grateful that the number is something like 143,000. That said, first of all, we got to remember that like refugees and humanitarian intakes there's a process. And I think people have to have faith in that process. You know, you have to follow the rules. And it's not fair to other migrants who, you know, follow the rules and tick all the right boxes and submit applications for others to jump the queue and sort of just barge into this country. It's not fair to them. And I think it undermines trust in the process as a whole for Canadians, right? Like, I think most Canadians are willing to accept the idea that we have some humanitarian obligations, but we want to be confident about who's coming in here. Have we screened them properly? Are they following the process? And when you have all things like Wroxham Road, it completely undermines that, and rightly so. So, you know, we really have to have a proper process in place that people respect, and that there are consequences for people who don't follow the process. The last thing is just generally, I mean, the humanitarian stream is different than the economic stream, right? We bring people here on the economic stream because there's economic benefit. For the humanitarian stream, it really comes down to, you know, what is our carrying capacity at any given moment in any given time? It's just like a household that decides to make charitable donations, right? If you're having a good year, you can give a little bit more to charity. If you're not, you have to cut back. You have to pay your own bills first. You have to take care of your own family first. And I think that the same has to be true of refugees and if there are good times, I think Canada should probably take more. But if we're experiencing tough times and we need to spend more money on Canadians, we have to cut back. We have to reduce that number. That's just it's the only way you're going to maintain political support. And I think it's completely consistent with the way most people sort of govern their own household finances.
Well, this kind of goes back to the idea that Canada had a sort of a historic purpose of its immigration system 50 to 100 years ago, and that has changed and we haven't really caught up. Look, Canada has so many natural advantages when it comes to immigration, which you discussed. Like, we don't share a border, right? It's actually quite difficult to get to Canada, and both Canada and the US broadly have visa requirements from like the third world or developing countries. So it's harder for those people to even get here. So to me, I mean, the fact that 143,000 people, yeah, it's not as much as the millions of people that are streaming across the Mexican border into the United States, but it's still a problem. Yeah, it's not nothing, and it's so out of whack with our traditional number. One of the things I noticed in your piece, Aaron, was that you were talking about how there was over a million people that came to Canada in 2022. I crunched the numbers, and when you add together, so we're at 500,000 for permanent residents, we're at 660,000 for temporary foreign workers, 900,000 for students, 150,000, 140,000 for asylum seekers. We're looking at two. I mean, my math says 2.2 million. So I guess, what do you think the right number is, and how do you calculate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first number to look at is definitely the students, right? That is the easiest one to reduce. Now, that some of the colleges and universities won't like it because that obviously impacts the bottom line. But other than them as the stakeholders, that is probably the single biggest piece of that 2.2 million that you can address most quickly. The PR stream, I mean, that is on paper supposed to be the one that most closely matches our economic needs. That's probably the toughest one. The migration one, things like tying up rocks and road, you can probably reduce. And then the TFW is a completely other kettle of fish, right? And we've kind of gone all over the map on this over the last 20 years. You know, there are a lot of people in the business community that said, you know, if we don't have TFWs, then I can't run my business. A lot of governments sort of acceded to those demands. Like I said, I think there needs to be a fundamental rethink about why is it, like, if there are Canadians in certain parts of the country or certain demographics that are not working, and we're seeing like low workforce participation in some of these demographics, and yet we have to import temporary foreign workers, that suggests there's something else going on. There's something wrong with the incentives. There's something wrong with government entitlements. We need to address that first. You can't just paper over that by importing TFWs. So I think the student stream, the TFWs, are the two easiest ones from a policy standpoint to correct. Refugees and asylum claims, that is an enforcement issue. And then the toughest one to crack is PR. But even addressing two of those four categories could easily slice that number in half relatively quickly.
Okay, let's talk about the permanent residents. And I found a graph from Stats Canada. I love this graph. I always look at it. This shows the Canada's historic intake of immigrants from starting in 1952. So this goes all the way back. For some reason, they archived this page and they stopped showing the new numbers. But we can talk about what the new numbers are. This is just landed immigrants. They used to call them landed immigrants, but it's actually permanent residents. And so, Aaron, you could see that this graph, just from like a step away, you see peaks and valleys. So there's a pretty big bump right around Confederation in the 1880s, another big bump in the early, the first decade of the 20th century, between sort of 1905 and 1910, a little bump during World War One, huge post-war bump in the 50s, and then kind of up and down and up and down and up and down. And then you hit the 90s and you just sort of see a wall, and it never goes down. It just goes up and up and stops here in 2012. Back when the number was 250, we now know the number is 500. So just imagine that the graph just continues upwards without any gaps all the way. And, you know, we're at 500. The tallest peak on this graph from 1910 was 400,000. So we're now higher than the highest peak in Canadian history. Well, one of the things, Aaron, that strikes me about this graph is that we always had the valleys, right? So basically what would happen is that we would have a couple of years where there would be a huge surge in immigration and we'd let in a whole bunch of people, and then the doors would kind of close and we'd have a few years to sort of integrate everybody and to make sure that everyone becomes Canadian and that the communities kind of merge together, and then we open it up again. And It seems to me that starting in the 90s or maybe the early 2000s, that kind of tradition just fell apart. And instead of doing the sort of gaps and open and close, open and close, open and close, we just like left it open. And it's like we're living through that experiment right now. You talked a little bit about the cultural element of multiculturalism just not quite working, and some people feeling uneasy about how much their community has changed. What's your comment on that?
Yeah, this is still the third rail here, right? Is that we can talk about the economic issues and things like pressures on infrastructure, but people don't want to get into the cultural friction element because it can be very uncomfortable for a lot of people. They don't want to seem like a racist. Now, to go back to your point about the peaks and valleys, I don't know if that was the government's deliberate intention to, you know, allow for these sort of breathers to allow for integration. I suspect a lot of it was economically driven, but the effect was still to allow for that cultural integration. And I also think when you go back 100 years, in a lot of cases, you're talking about, you know, migration, for example, to rural areas, which was a lot greater. Today, the overwhelming majority of migration is to urban areas, especially our already largest urban areas. So it's a very different process in terms of, you know, integration. I know assimilation is a charged word for a lot of people, but just the idea of, and I think this is true of every country, you know, most people, when they move to another country, they sort of understand implicitly that they're supposed to, over time, and certainly their children over generations, adopt the ways of that country. That doesn't mean that you have to give up everything you know from the homeland, but over time, there's just this sort of natural process where people acculturate, acclimate to where they're from. I mean, it's certainly the case in my family. You know, my mother's from Hong Kong. I was born here. My wife's family's from Trinidad. I know your husband's family comes from Iran. You know, these are processes that naturally occur over time. And absent some kind of active government policy trying to interfere with that, that's both what newcomers expect to do and what Canadians already here sort of expect of newcomers. And we haven't had that. You talk about big M multiculturalism. I think that is part of the problem here. It's not small M multiculturalism. I mean, the idea of people kind of doing their own thing is not the problem. It's this official policy where it's almost like state doctrine where you're supposed to try and preserve stuff from the past, and if you don't, you're almost doing something wrong, or you're letting go of something, and that's a bad thing. That is part of the problem, and it has created this tension between people who feel that you know, people who are coming here are not part of a common national project and are sort of clinging to things from the homeland. So I think that we need to have that open conversation. But what are the expectations? You know, what is our capacity, right? Because I think a lot of people, it comes down to numbers. If you live in a community and you welcome people who come from different places and speak different languages, and if some of them come into your neighborhood, that's no deal. If you wake up one morning and suddenly every single one of your neighbors is from somewhere else, that can be jolting. That can be shocking for a lot of people. And it's just human nature. Some people are uncomfortable by rapid change of any sort. And I think we need to make accommodation for that. It doesn't make you a bad person or make you hateful to say, I kind of like the way things are, and any change that comes, I want it to be gradual and I want to get used to it. And I would resent the idea that this is just going to be, I'm just going to be overwhelmed by different things tomorrow morning without being able to have any say in it.
Well, it's interesting. So much of what you just said was super interesting. The peaks and valleys that you didn't necessarily think that was intentional. That was just sort of like reacting to world events or whatever. But the outcome was this sort of integration that would happen. Mm-hmm. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, like, you know, if you live in a community and there's one or two newcomers, everybody's like really excited about those newcomers. And it's like, oh, where are they from? Let's help them make sure that they fit into the community. Like, they have kids that are around my kids' age. Let's like make sure that they are playing together. And you have a community that's focused on helping those people. And that's what happens with the private refugee sponsorship when churches and charities sponsor refugees. It's like the people who sponsor that refugee feel a personal obligation to help them integrate, to make sure
it becomes a rallying point, right? It becomes a rallying point. And the problem is when you make it too much, it starts to feel like an imposition. And that's the line you don't want to cross. You want the attitude towards immigrants to be welcoming and help them integrate. And it's a win-win, right? And when you go too far and you tip it too far the other way, it starts to become a burden and resentment. That's where we don't want to go. And that's what I'm saying. That's part of the reason I keep making these arguments is I do think immigration at the right level in the right way is a good thing and we should support it. But we're over that line right now. And that's the reason we're seeing a lot of this backlash.
Well, yeah, like you're really testing the generosity of Canadians, because I think that when that happens, it still does happen. I think probably in small towns, Aaron, where someone gets excited, like, oh, we have a newcomer and they're from this different culture and everyone's interested and the teacher wants the child to talk about it at school or whatever. But then you look at neighborhoods like, you know, I grew up in Vancouver, and I've talked about this on my show a bit before, but like the neighborhood that I grew up in doesn't exist anymore in the way that it did when I was a child, right? Like in the 80s and the 90s, it was just a whole bunch of like basically like stay-at-home moms. Every house had like three or four kids. There's kids playing, riding their bikes all over. It was a very vibrant, lively neighborhood, Kerrisdale in Vancouver. And like 10 years later, it just wasn't anymore. It was like the Hong Kong takeover announcement had happened, and you know, thousands of people just kind of moved to that one neighborhood, liked that neighborhood. And, you know, my parents sold their house because we had an offer on the house. It was way more than we paid. So we moved to a different suburb. And like, I go back there now and it's like, this is just such a different area. There's like no children, there's no kids. And yeah. And the community is gone. I know some people that are from places like Brampton and they grew up there and it was a totally different scenario. Now you go back and you almost feel like a little bit of a loss. Like the country that I grew up in isn't really there anymore. Do you think those are valid feelings, or how can you work around that?
Yeah, look, I think change is inevitable, but the rate of change is not inevitable. And so it's not that, you know, we have to freeze everything in time. And I do think some people fall prey to this like nostalgia of like everything was great the way when I was a kid. And so I think we have to guard against that. But that's not to say that we just have to accept any change anywhere all the time as this sort of fatalistic. We get to choose. We get to help determine the rate of change that works best for everyone. And I also think, too, you know, a lot of people conflate a discomfort. They conflate what I would say sort of race with culture. I think what a lot of people, what bothers them about the idea of change isn't that they're going to be replaced by someone who has a different skin tone than them. It's that the things they value as a Canadian, you know, cultural traditions, you know, certain values, if those things are lost, that's the real problem. So like, to give you an example, I know it's an old trope, but like, you know, hockey is an essentially quintessentially Canadian thing. So if you had a whole bunch of migrants come to a community that had a strong hockey tradition, and all those immigrants over time took up hockey and started playing hockey and themselves became the sort of carriers of that tradition, I don't think anyone would care. But what does bother people is that people come and then there's sort of no interest in hockey and the sort of that tradition dies out. And that's, again, that's not a racial thing. That's sort of a cultural integration thing. So I don't buy this. You know, there's some sort of, I do think it's a racist view that, you know, replacement is based on, you know, your skin color or your ethnic origin. I think it's a cultural question. And I think it's a question that culture can be learned. And if you have willing partners on the welcoming side and the new arrival side, willing to integrate, willing to assimilate, you can still carry on. It's not replacement. It's different people carrying on the same cultural traditions. And so I think we got to be very careful about that debate, because I think some people, they mix up those things too easily, and they're really not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I have a personal anecdote about that. Like, I was really interested in field hockey when I was a kid. And when I went into like a new team, I was in grade three, and I was the only girl in grade three that wanted to play field hockey. And it was partially like, you know, I had wonderful neighbors, and I have friends from that time who were from Hong Kong, whose families had moved. And the things that they were interested in, it was more like, you know, piano and different kinds of like the arts, which is great. I mean, I actually think that people bringing different kind of interests and values makes the community richer and it makes it more interesting. It just so happened that there was not enough girls in my year to create a field hockey team, so I had to go play in a different district. So it's funny that you mentioned that. But yeah, again, I think it's like the difference between having, you know, a handful of people join a district versus like having tens of thousands that all come at the same time and kind of flood the system. Sure. And just completely change the culture and the community.
It's totally about the speed in a lot of cases. And the other thing too to remember is, you know, in the West, and especially in the Anglosphere countries, I mean, there's a reason we're very appealing destinations for people from all over the world. And so we should bear that in mind when some people argue, well, you know, are we, you know, imposing ourselves on these new arrivals? I mean, they're coming here because they already know what it's like here. They already have a sense of what it's like. They want to join our project. And so this idea that the first thing we do when we tell them when they show up is, you know what, you should just keep everything the way it is and you don't have to. I think that's a strange message that hits a lot of their ears almost weirdly. And, you know, I obviously have no issue with people doing their own thing. And, you know, I come from, you know, my dad's side of the family is German Canadian. I'm from Kitchener, Ontario. It says old German Canadian community. There's still sort of old traditions that linger there, right? But it's not in terms of the mainstream and sort of the day-to-day life and preferences and culture, it's similar to the anywhere else in the country. And I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, if communities want to band together and of their own whim sort of preserve certain traditions, that they're certainly welcome to do that. They don't need the government to have an official policy of preservation or in some cases even subsidize that difference. I don't necessarily, you know, I have no problem with small D diversity. It's when, I guess, Candace, when you start to capitalize a lot of these policies into government doctrine, that's where you start to run into trouble.
Yeah, when you have someone telling you that diversity is your strength. And that's not a slogan, that's like an order, right? Yeah. Talk about forced assimilation. You know, you're from Kitchener. It used to be called Old Berlin, right? And then the government forced you to change the name of that community because they didn't want the German affiliation.
I think they had a referendum, but the point was
referendum went the other way. Didn't the referendum
there was this it's interesting because at the time, this was during the First World War, and I guess the Berlin City Council wanted to show that German Canadians were loyal to the Empire and not to Germany. So they had this referendum and they picked Lord Kitchener as the name. But it was interesting because at the time, it seemed important to show that you were committed to the country, right? And I think today that is something a lot of Canadians feel like. It may not even be true. I do think there are a lot of immigrants that are proud to be Canadian, and frankly, in a lot of cases, would love to shout it from the rooftops. But they often have governments telling them, no, you don't need to worry about that. You can carry on, you know, everything that you bring from the homeland. So I just find it interesting that, you know, if you go back 100 years, there's a community that was so concerned about not being seen as like sufficiently patriotic, they actually changed the name of the community because they wanted to signal that no. Like we're Canadian, our loyalty is here. It's not from not to our ancestral homeland.
Well, that's such a more optimistic way of looking at it, Aaron, than the way I saw it. I think you still see a little bit of that today. Like I've talked about this in the past as well. Like my husband was born in Iran, and they fled the mullahs and they fled the Islamic regime in the 90s. And Kaz is like the most patriotic Canadian that I know. Like he has a maple leaf tattoo and he's just like, he loves Canada. He wants the Canadian identity. He embraces like even the cheesiest aspects of Canadiana, right? And it's interesting because now in this like kind of like post-Canada world where everyone's woke and we have to like denounce our ancestors and everybody's so ashamed of what the Canadians did to, early Canadians did in developing the country. It's like, it's such a mixed message to newcomers because on the one hand, they're coming to Canada because they like Canada and they're excited about the opportunity. And that's the kind of like new like lifeline that you want coming into your country. You want people coming in who are enthusiastic, who want to start businesses, who want to start jobs, who love the country, who like wrap themselves in the flag. But then you have the sort of like elites or the kind of old stock Canadians sitting here talking about how awful Canada is and how it's this horrible, racist, genocidal country. It's so sad.
It can be bewildering for new migrants who come here and to be told that Canada is this horrible place that's got a racist past. I mean, a lot of these people, the first thing they say is, where I come from, I mean, compared to where I come from, we have real problems back where I'm from. I mean, Canada, these problems pale in comparison. And I think a lot of Canadians lack that context. Like, is there racism in Canada? Of course there is. But like relative, and as someone who's, in a mixed race relationship, who's lived in many places around the world, I mean, I've experienced racism everywhere. I've experienced the least racism in Canada compared to all these other places, including other developed countries. So I think, it's one thing to say, yeah, of course we always want to combat racism. But the idea that Canada is sort of uniquely or particularly racist is just mind-boggling to most people who have lived anywhere else.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the sort of racism that you do encounter, like one of my best friends growing up was half Chinese and half, her mom was from Newfoundland, so she was like a Newfie, half Chinese. And people kind of came up with silly little nicknames to describe her ethnicity, but it was always like in a kind of loving way. And I remember asking her once if it bothered her, and she was like, no, it's hilarious, right? Like, it's not meant to be mean. It's like kids kind of make jokes maybe to like ease the tension, and we used to be able to do that, and now it's like everything's so politically correct you can't even make jokes like that.
Yeah, and I firmly believe that most of what's called racism in a lot of cases is just a lack of familiarity or in some cases clumsiness, right? I think that, you know, there's very few people that have some sort of deep ideological belief in like racial superiority or purity. There's just not very many of those people. Most yeah. people, it is just a casual unfamiliarity or in some cases discomfort. And that's a natural thing, right? Like the analogy I made has been to people who, people have different food preferences, right? Like some people love trying new things. Other people, like, they know exactly what they like and they don't want to try anything new. And I think that's like that with personalities and cultures. Some people just know what they like and they, other stuff seems weird and strange. And other people, they just love trying new stuff and they love sort of learning about new cultures and languages and things like that. Neither of those things is right or wrong. It's just a personality difference. And I think we do a disservice to like truly like deep-seated ideological racism when we kind of conflate clumsiness or just discomfort with some sort of really nefarious, like evil racism.
Yeah. I mean, when I listen to Jordan Peterson talk about personality traits and he talks about like trait openness versus like yeah. people who are low in openness, that's basically what it is. Like I happen to be really high in openness. I love traveling around the world. You know, I'm interested in other cultures. I married someone from a different culture. Like I just happen to be high in openness where someone else might not be. And that's not their fault. It doesn't make them sure. a bad person. It's just who they are. Okay. Well, Aaron, I want to talk about one other thing. I know you've got to run in a minute here. We've had a great conversation. I really appreciate it. Let's get into the kind of crux of the matter, right? Like we're told that part of the reason why we need mass migration, why we need so many people, it's not just economic, it's not cultural, it's about fertility rates and it's about the declining birth rate. The numbers in Canada have come out and it's truly shocking. Our fertility rate is 1.1 right now. Okay. Mm-hmm. Replacement is 2.1. It used to be that women used to have, you know, many, many children. Obviously things have changed and most children now survive into adulthood. But it seems to me that immigration kind of covers up this other issue, which is that Canadian families aren't having as many kids as they used to. And we talked about this in the other interview we did. There's a Carta study showing that most women want to have more children than they're actually having. About 25% of women don't end up having kids even though they wanted kids because they can't find a right partner, they can't make it work. Like to me, this is a huge, huge issue in our culture and in our world that just gets like no attention. Like nobody talks about it. Maybe because it's such a personal choice and it's so personal that people feel uncomfortable talking about it in terms of public policy. But you know, we're here to have an uncomfortable conversation. So, you know, you've got a big family, you got a bunch of kids. So maybe you can give us some insights and talk about what you think needs to be done.
Yeah, I'm great. I'm doing what I can to pull up that 1.1. I've got three, but and I wish I had more. Look, it's hard to think of any other issue where if women had this big a concern, the government would just completely ignore it, right? I mean, if there was a survey that showed, you know, 60% of women said that they're paying too much for hygienic products, I mean, the government would drop everything and like fix that. And yet here we have a lot of evidence that, you know, a vast majority of women are not having as many children as they want. Well, what are governments doing about that? That seems to me like it should be a central like policy fixation for any government that's concerned, not just about women, but about, you know, the birth rate generally. You're absolutely right that immigration is just being used to paper over that. And that's a problem for a couple of reasons. One, it's not going to be enough. You know, you probably need a mix of higher birth rates and immigration to maintain growth. And I am pro-growth. I'm not one of these people that believes you can shrink. You know, people talk about Japan shrinking. I'm like, talk to me in 20 years. I think Japan has other issues there.
No,
that
it's a
are,
tragedy in Japan when you go to the suburbs and there's just like ghost towns right outside of Tokyo. It
is a real problem. I think people fixate on the fact, oh, Japan's still a wealthy place. They are coasting and they are slowly shriveling and declining, and that is a real problem. The other thing too that people will mention is a lot of the immigrants we do get, once they come here, guess what? They start to adopt the same lifestyle choices, and so the fertility rate actually drops amongst second generation immigrants. So you're not actually solving the problem in the long run. I would say, Candace, this is a problem afflicting the whole world, especially the developed world. You know, Canada is even middle of the pack. This places like Korea are down to like 0.8 children. It is a real problem. I know what you've mentioned places like in Hungary. There are some other countries where they're attempting some pretty radical policy pulling some really levers, like, you know, making income tax free if you have four children or more. There, you know, there's some encouraging examples. Japan has a few examples like that are encouraging. you know, I do fear a bit that part of this is cultural, that we live in a very increasingly atomized, individualized world where sort of self-fulfillment and career and sort of, you know, individual needs or adult needs are supplanting what used to be like longstanding evolutionary driven needs to have children. And that's hard to reverse. But we should try and we should pull every lever we can. And I think that governments we basically haven't emptied the tank yet on seeing what governments can do to move the needle on fertility, because we're not even talking about it at all, as you say. And I think that's a conversation in the coming years that policymakers really need to focus on.
Well, I find that there's so much pessimism around it. Like, it's like, okay, so Asia's been dealing with this issue for decades and they've tried a lot of stuff, right? Like Singapore's tried a lot of different policies to encourage families to have kids. And basically what they found was that the people who already probably planned on having kids just had kids sooner,
yep.
But it didn't actually like increase the total number. And so then we just like throw those policies out and we're like, okay, we're not going to do those anymore. But it's like, we haven't tried those in Canada, right? The idea of, providing longer parental leave or allowing mom to stay home with the kids for like 3 or 4 years. And I think that there's a lot. I think when I think of my generation, a lot of my friends, you know, we were really told that we could be anything and do anything. And the emphasis was to go to university, like figure out what you want to do, the whole like personal fulfillment thing. And then by the time you're done university, you're kind of on a track to either go to professional school or go get a career. Okay, well, I've put all this effort into school. I don't want to leave the market place when I'm 25. I want to stay. Yeah, I want to stay and I want to focus on my career. And then by the time you're like looking around at having kids, you're like into your 30s and your window is really small. A lot of people struggle to even get pregnant and have kids in their 30s. And that's the norm. Like the norm is that women are having kids in their 30s. In my friend group, it was like mid-30s that people were starting to have kids. Yep. And you know, if you always wanted to have three kids, you always want to have four kids, and you start when you're 35, like you just
hard.
It's really hard to do that. And I don't think that women are being told the truth. That's why I think it is feminism. It's like lies that we tell women that they're going to have personal fulfillment from some career that they may love. You may love your career, but look, if you're in your 40s and you miss that window and you can't have kids, that biological instinct that you talked about, it's going to come up and it's going to hit you hard. And it's tragic. It's really sad when that does happen. I really deeply feel for women who miss the opportunity. And I feel like more people need to talk about that so that younger women don't make those same mistakes.
Yeah. We have to do another podcast just on this issue. Cause I do think there's a, there's a cultural challenge in that, like, parenting is hard, but it's rewarding. And we live in a society now where increasingly everything is all about you, and parenting is a sacrifice, and the sort of benefits of it, the sort of rewards of it, are diffuse and over time, and in a lot of cases you only notice them years later. That's a hard sell to people, where it's like you can have a career, you can travel, and you can sort of get everything you want well into your 30s, and then, as you say, even if you want kids, then maybe you're having one or maybe two. You're not having three or four anymore. And it's just everything else in our culture is pushing against this idea of the value of parenting, which seems like a whole lot of work to people that want to have a busy career and travel and have, do those other self-fulfillment things. So, it's going to take some work, but I do think there's going to be a reckoning at some point, because we're going to reach a point where birth rates could continue to decline to the point where now we have problems even sustaining the sort of the social safety net that we have, for example. There's not going to be enough people work, especially with longer lifespans. So it is a challenge. And I agree with you as a parent, you know, it's the most rewarding, the most important thing I do in my life. And it's really hard to explain that to somebody who doesn't have kids without sounding kind of sappy and sentimental. But it does have real consequences. Once you miss that window, there's no going back.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. We're going to have to do a whole other podcast on this, Aaron, because, you know, you could talk about the macro issues like social safety nets, and then you could talk about the individual feelings of people. There's been some interesting, I feel like at least the conversation is being had more, and I see it more in podcasts, but I think it's going to take a lot more than just, the two of us talking about how great it is to be parents and how wonderful and fulfilling it is to have little kids. I have three kids, and we actually have one on the way. So we're going to have four kids.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're pretty excited and pretty overwhelmed. But anyway, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. I enjoyed and appreciated the conversation on immigration. And I think we really have our work cut out for us as a country, but I like your optimism when it comes to, you know, this, we have to have these difficult conversations so that we can save our immigration system so that we don't lose that consensus. And I think that's a really important takeaway message.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks so much for the wide-ranging chat. Pleasure to be
okay. here. All right, Aaron, take care. That's Aaron Lee Woodrick from the McDonald Laurier Institute. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Candace Malcolm, and this is the Candace Malcolm Show.